Today is February 23rd, 2015. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Today is a public hearing on House Bill 5002. It's the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And before we open the public hearing, we'll turn it over to staff.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just wanted to note for the record that there are a number of materials saved on OLIS under today's date, including the agency's presentation materials. And the LFO presentation, we have a short budget review of issues related to the Department of Agriculture. And a couple of other things, I would note that there was a budget note current biennium for the department supposed to report during their Ways and Means hearing using information provided by USDA APHIS Wildlife Services on the wildlife conflicts responded to by wildlife service agents, by species, resource type, methods used to address the conflict, summarized by county. And that information is saved in OLIS under the ODA budget note. And then there were two items identified in the co-chair's budget framework as targeted investments related to this department. One related to their laboratory to ensure they meet the federal guidelines and have the capacity to meet testing demands, and another to help the state or for the state to share the cost of the administrative function of the department to ease the burden on the other fund fee payers. And that's it for LFO, Mr. Chair.
All right. And with that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5002, and we'll go ahead and call up Ms. Koba, Ms. Hansen, and Mr. Henderson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With me is Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director, and then Dustin Ball with DAS,
Chief Financial Office.
I was going to go back to the old acronym, BAM.
Works too.
Tell us how long I've been here. And we just wanted to note for the members that are here, this is a busy week for us as well. We've got policy bills up in House Agriculture. So Deputy Director Hansen will be in and out, and we just wanted to make sure that you didn't feel that was something you had said that made her leave or come late, but she'll be bouncing in and out, and we'll do the best we can in terms of managing lots of stuff going on. So we'll be spending this week with you talking about the Department of Agriculture's budget, and my goal is to get through our presentation by Wednesday, and then my understanding is you have public testimony scheduled for Thursday. So we'll try to stay on track. The Oregon Department of Agriculture's key targets when we do our work is to achieve desired outcomes through technical assistance and strong relationships with our partners. One of the things that we talk about a lot in our agency is education and outreach in a number of our programs, even in our regulatory programs. So our approach with our staff is to work closely with those that we regulate. We try to keep them out of trouble before they get close to being in trouble. If we think they're getting close to trouble, we really try to reach out to them and provide resources for them to access. And then with our regulatory programs, we do ultimately have a regulatory backstop that we use if necessary. But our whole first goal is to work in partnership with the industry in terms of education and outreach. We are a very diverse agency. I think you will find that here over the course of the next 3 days. And I think that's reflective as well of the diversity of the industry that we serve. Agriculture in this state is very diverse, and therefore it drives a lot of programs in our agency that are very diverse. We believe we fulfill very unique niches in our agency. We have that regulatory role that I spoke about. We also have a promotion role. We have a number of fee-for-service programs where the industry pays the cost of delivering those services. And all of this variety of service delivery mechanisms help us believe we achieve desired outcomes for our agency. The industry in Oregon, agriculture has changed dramatically over the last 10 to 20 years, and we expect that moving forward into the future. And as a result, we in the agency believe that we need to constantly be reviewing what we do, how we deliver our services, and try to keep up with that change within the industry that we serve. At the same time, we've seen a number of budget challenges, particularly in natural resources agencies over the last 15 years, and we, being one of those natural resources agencies, have seen a lot of fund shifting and loss of general fund, increase in lottery funds, loss of lottery funds, fund shift to other funds. It's been a fairly tumultuous time to try to provide a sustainable budget for natural resources agencies. And one of our long-term goals moving forward is to try to set the budget in a place that it is more sustainable and not quite so up and down as we move into the future. The Oregon Department of Agriculture has a threefold mission. First is to ensure food safety and consumer protection. Secondly, protect the natural resources base for present and future generations of farmers and ranchers. And third, promote economic development and expanded market opportunities for Oregon agriculture. You can see our core values, and I've spoken to some of those. Technical and professional competence. We approach our work with honesty, integrity, and fairness. Respect for people and property. Practical approaches to problem solving. And last but certainly not least, providing quality customer service. We have five program unit areas, as depicted in this program chart, and my goal is to get through three of these five today. This is our organizational chart. It might look a little different than some other agencies, and we've gone through some organizational change in the last 2 to 3 years that I'll speak to later in the presentation. But at the top, you can see we do have State Board of Agriculture. It's a 10-member board that's appointed by the governor, and it's a policymaking board to the agency. The rulemaking authority within the Department of Agriculture rests in the position of the director. We have a deputy director, an assistant director, and then we have our five program areas. You can see the list of programs within each of those areas. Again, that represents the diversity of programs that we have in our agency. And as I go through the program areas, I'm not going to have time to touch on each and every one of those programs. I'm going to highlight some in particular, but if you have questions about any of the others, don't hesitate to ask. With that, we'll start with our market access and certification programs, and this is part of our agency that really works on the promotion of the agriculture industry in the state of Oregon. Program goals for this area include fostering vibrant local food economies and jobs. I would say in my tenure as director, this is an area that has really grown in terms of passion of Oregonians for local food. We see it in so many different ways. If you're walking through downtown Portland and the local food carts now coming and in the Portland airport, certainly farmers markets and the explosion that we've seen in those around the state, farm direct marketing, community supported agriculture, farm to restaurant work, farm to school programs. I could just go on and on and on, and Representative Clem smiles, but he's been very active in efforts to help foster these local food economies and jobs. And a lot of discussion as well about how can we provide better avenues for smaller farmers to get products and access larger local and regional markets. A lot of that is challenges around the distribution system. So many entities, not just the Department of Agriculture, working on issues here. Certainly, we continue our work in creating opportunities in regional and international markets as well. I think it's important to note that the agriculture industry in Oregon, I always talk about markets as a three-legged stool. We have our local markets, our domestic markets, and our international markets. 80% of what we produce in the state of Oregon in terms of agriculture leaves our state's borders. So about 20% of what we produce stays within Oregon. Of that 80%, half moves into an international market. So the work that we do in marketing, whether it's local, domestic, or international, is very, very important to the stability of Oregon's agriculture industry. And then finally, we do a lot of technical work in the market area as well that I think most people don't recognize. We call it kind of the back behind the curtain expertise, if you will. We do inspections, audits, certifications of all kinds of products in order to move them into the market. And if you're moving product outside of Oregon's borders, probably 90 to 95% of what you're moving we have touched in some way in terms of an inspection, an audit, or a certification. So in terms of what's happening in local foods, and in particular what we in the Department of Agriculture are working on, as I said, there's all kinds of efforts around the local food movement, and we by no means are driving all of those efforts. But ones that we'd like to highlight include growing the farm-to-school program. Again, Representative Clem was instrumental in getting this program initially funded, and I'm happy to report that the growth in this program is really quite phenomenal. We now have 80 public school districts around the state that are involved in the state's farm-to-school program in one way or another. And then within the last biennium, the U.S. government started a new program called the Food Corps program, and Oregon is one of the first states to get Food Corps members active in our state. It's like AmeriCorps, but around food. And so we have Food Corps fellows that come into Oregon and work with schools, work with school gardens, teaching children about how to grow food, how to eat healthy. It's a very exciting program, and I can tell you these Food Corps volunteers are really, truly amazing individuals. Secondly, we have the Celebrate Oregon Agriculture campaign that has been ongoing now for a couple of biennium. This is a program that's funded out of the Specialty Crop Block Grant program, whereby we're really trying to raise the profile of Oregon agriculture, targeting a Portland market and targeting parents of young children to really continue this message about what we can grow in Oregon, healthy products, what you can grow or access easily in your neighborhood, and then how you can prepare those foods at home with your children. So a goal of raising the profile of Oregon agriculture, but as well really targeting young children and getting them to understand better how to access local healthy products and how to prepare them at home. We have a number of USDA grants that we administer that help with this local food effort. The Specialty Crop Block Grant Program is a program that's funded under the Farm Bill, and these are dollars that are distributed to states on a formula basis. And we turn around, and the majority of the money that we get, we then block grant out to help market Oregon agriculture. A number of those block grants do go to local food efforts. We administer the National Organic Cost Share Reimbursement Program and the Farm Direct Nutrition Program, which has created an additional customers for over 700 farmers around the state. In 2009 alone, over $1 million were paid to Oregon farmers through the Farm Direct programs. Moving into international markets, the Oregon Department of Agriculture is internationally recognized for its marketing program. It's very well known in foreign countries with both of our customers as well as foreign ag service members in the federal government. And there are a number of things that we try to do with our international program. First of all, particularly in Asian markets, we work very closely with governments to resolve trade barriers for Oregon products. Many of the trade barriers we experience are what we call non-tariff trade barriers. So someone finds a pest or claims that they found a pest or disease or whatnot, and we get actively involved in trying to remove those trade barriers for Oregon products. We obviously work on traditional methods, trade missions, and trade shows to both maintain and develop new markets. As an example, this is a photo taken from a joint Oregon-Washington Department of Agriculture mission last fall with potato commissions of both states, as well as some onion growers and blueberry growers, focusing on new market potential in Vietnam and Philippines. And while potatoes were certainly the focus, and by potatoes I mean fresh market potatoes into these markets, I have to say that blueberries stole the show. Blueberries are all the rage right now in Asia, and we're seeing, as a result of that, incredible growth in the planting of blueberries here in Oregon. Bullet number three is a topic on everyone's radar screen right now. But obviously, being able to get product to market is very critical. If we have 80% of our product that leaves our state borders, but we can't move it into a market, we've got a big problem. And that's what we've seen now with the West Coast port slowdown. So we work a lot with on the infrastructure side, making sure that as best we can, we have the ability to get products to market in a competitive and efficient manner. And we also, in our agency, have a program that is perhaps not well known, but we oversee price negotiations amongst some commodities in Oregon, grass seed in particular, as well as seafood. And this, because of our oversight, it does provide a safe harbor for growers and fishermen and processors to come together to negotiate price and provide stability in the market. Again, as I'd mentioned earlier, we do a lot of just basic inspection work in order to allow products to go to market. Our services are broad and statewide. As I said, we inspect and certify nearly all agriculture and livestock products that are sold inside and outside of Oregon. This is things like grass seed, fruits and vegetables, livestock as mentioned. And these are required inspections in order to move your product. So for our industry, which, I grew up in a farm family, and there's nothing as intense as harvest time, you know, getting the crop harvested and getting it moved, we need to make sure that we're providing the service to our industry so that we're not a bottleneck for them. We've got to be there on time when they need that inspection and provide it quickly and get that certificate to them so they can continue moving their product. We are one of the top states in the nation in terms of the number of phytosanitary certificates issued. And we use this expertise within our agency to develop voluntary certification programs as well. Organic certification, we do organic certification. We do weed-free forage certification. We do salmon safe certification. So if there are folks that want us to do certifications on a number of different kinds of programs, we offer that service on a fee-for-service basis. So that sums up our market access and certification programs. Certainly, if you have any other questions or anything else you wanted me to touch on in that program area, we can do it now. Or if not, we can move on.
Any questions? Seeing none, please proceed.
Oh, yes.
I was just curious about the the trade missions and developing new markets. I was curious, so you went over with potatoes, blueberries. I'm just, how does that, you know, over, say, a biennium, what type of results do you generally see?
Mr. Co-Chair, I think it's important to note that the work we do with trade missions and trade shows is a very long-term effort. And I'll give the example of blueberries again. We worked in concert with the industry and the U.S. federal government for 10 years to try to open up South Korea to fresh blueberries. We were successful in doing that 2 years ago. Currently, we're the only state in the United States that can ship fresh blueberries into South Korea. My fellow colleagues give me a hard time about that. But that is an example. When we're talking about work in opening up a new market, we stress to the industry that this is a long-term commitment. So potatoes, fresh potatoes into Vietnam and Philippines, they've been working on this for about 4 years now. The results have been mixed. We've had some good success in terms of containers moving in, and then the next year the market could dry up, and there's a number of factors that drive that. Part of the challenge, frankly, is Vietnamese and Filipinos don't really know how to cook with fresh potatoes. And so what do you do with this thing? I mean, their staple in their diet is rice. So we work a lot with some of the high-end chefs and chef schools over there and give them ideas about how to prepare these products and target Western kinds of places where we know those that are interested in Western cuisine would go. So American restaurants in foreign countries and places like that. So it's not an easy effort, and it's a big time commitment as well as dollar commitment. And we try to be clear about that to the industry up front, so that if you're going to go into these markets, be prepared to be there for the long term.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Since we're talking about the export side, what are you hearing from folks about what's happening at the ports and their ability to move goods and products out of Oregon?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, it's been a nightmare, to be honest. And we've heard a lot of frustration and, frankly, people that come to us and say, why aren't you fixing it? And I wish that I could, but unfortunately, there's not a whole lot that we can do at the state level. I would say the governor's office has been engaged, and obviously Governor Brown, her first day after swearing in, joined with Washington and California's governor in terms of sending a letter to the ILWU and PMA. And a lot of what we've done is try to make our congressional delegation aware and ultimately the president. And it was the president that sent Secretary of Labor Perez to California last week to try to speed up the negotiations. Based on everything we've heard so far, that's happening, and that they've come to a tentative agreement, so we're hoping that that holds. The Port of Portland has, on top of the West Coast issue, its own unique challenge with ILWU and ICSI, which is the Terminal 6 operator. And they've had ongoing issues probably for 4 years now. And ultimately, as you've probably heard, Hanjin pulled out of their service to the port a couple of weeks ago. So it's the West Coast port slowdown, I think, exasperated that situation, but it's been ongoing before the port slowdown. So, our agriculture folks get very frustrated because they don't understand how to fix things, and so they come to us, and we do the best we can explaining to them how the process works and encouraging them to contact the appropriate officials that can deal with it.
Anything additional? Seeing none, please proceed.
The next program area is our natural resources program area. The goals for this area include working to improve water, soil, and air resources in Oregon. We work to reduce Oregonians' exposure to toxics while ensuring private and commercial use of crop protection tools. And we protect Oregon agricultural land use so future generations can continue to farm and produce the bounty that does indeed drive 15% of Oregon's economy. Some of the programs in this area, one that we've probably spent the majority of our time on in the last biennium is our agricultural water quality program. In this program, we work in partnership with a number of entities, first and foremost landowners, as well as DEQ, Department of Forestry, OWEB, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and other natural resources partners, and the federal government. And the whole goal really is to prevent agricultural impacts to water quality in the state or to improve water quality and reduce impacts from agriculture. This is a program that's been in place for 20 years now, but frankly, it's a program over the last 5 years or so that is receiving increasing attention and some criticism from some groups that don't believe that agriculture has stepped up and done its share in terms of reducing impacts on water quality. Part of the challenge that we've had in this program is really to be able to demonstrate what has been done. We've done what we call random acts of kindness for a couple of decades now, where we've worked with a number of different landowners all over the state to put projects in place in reducing water quality impacts. And I think those projects have been very successful. And frankly, farmers and ranchers around the state are proud of the work that they've done in this area. But being able to quantify what's been done has been a big challenge for us. And so in the last 2 to 3 years, we've really decided that we need to take the water quality program to the next step. And we've identified and adopted what we're calling strategic implementation areas. So we're picking areas around the state. We started this current biennium with two pilots, one in Wasco County and one in Clackamas County, whereby we're taking a stretch of stream We're doing an assessment of the riparian vegetation along that stream to determine what is in compliance with water quality plans for the Department of Agriculture and where we need additional work. And we plan to increase those number of pilots next biennium from the two that we're currently working on to another 6 to 8. And we believe this is really important to again, quantify the work that has been done and identify additional work that needs to be done. When we first started talking about moving the program to this level, I think there was a lot of questions, a lot of potential concerns from landowners. But what we're hearing now from people around the state is they're very excited about this program. They realize this is a tool for them to identify indeed what the good things that have happened, as well as if there are people that aren't holding up their end of the stick, if you will, that we can work with them to get them in compliance. A very critical partner for us in this work is our soil and water conservation districts, and we have 45 of those around the state. They've been in place for a long, long time working in areas, but they are a key partner for us in reaching out to landowners and providing technical assistance to bring landowners into compliance. This current biennium, we received new funding from the last legislature to step up our efforts on water reservations and working on increasing water supply around the state. And this is our part of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy work. Again, a number of natural resource partners in this effort, Water Resources Department clearly, as well as DEQ and Fish and Wildlife. And so we have a staff person funded for the first time this biennium that is indeed working with partners around the state to identify opportunities for both conserving water as well as identifying new supplies of water. And I would say moving forward, if we're going to pick one issue for agriculture that is absolutely critical, it is water, both water quality and water quantity. As we look at the impacts of climate change, we look at snowpack right now around the state, we know we're going to have irrigators cut off this summer. And irrigated land is the most productive land in the state, and we've got to have water in the future in order to allow agriculture to continue to be successful. In this program area as well, we operate the confined animal feeding operation, which permits all animal operations in the state and make sure they are also in compliance with water quality rules and regulations. Very high profile part of our agency here in the current biennium is our pesticides program. And in this program, we really are focused on reducing exposure to pollutants to impact that potentially could negatively impact people in the environment. As part of this program, we register and license over 12,000 products that are used in the state of Oregon, as well as 13,000 licensed commercial pesticide applicators, operators, and dealers. We have a very extensive outreach and education program to train those that are using these tools to make sure they're using them in compliance with federal and state laws. On an annual basis, we will conduct, on average, 500 investigations. 250 of those are often complaint generated, and we do 250 on average that we initiate, again, with the goal of keeping the people that are using these tools in compliance with the law. We have worked very hard in this current biennium around how the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, or PARC, operates. This is a interagency coordinating entity that's made up of a number of state agencies, obviously Department of Agriculture and Department of Health. Public Health are the two primary agencies and the co-chairs of PARC, but DEQ, Fish and Wildlife, Poison Control Center, OHSU, a number of other entities are also members of PARC. And PARC is, PARC's whole focus is to ensure cooperation when we have pesticide-related incidences that may involve humans or animals in the environment. We continue our work in close partnership with DEQ and implementing the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program. This is really a great story. The PSP program, which is a voluntary program driven by scientific testing and monitoring in the water, and when we identify places where we have pesticides in the water at levels that exceed standards, then we kind of do what we call SWAT team, and we pull together key players in that targeted area, landowners, experts, OSU, our agency staff, soil and water conservation districts, to really try to do an assessment of how we think those products are getting into the water and what kind of management practices could be put in place to reduce that potential. And we've seen success in a number of places around the state with this program. We're looking to expand it to two new sites next biennium. And then finally, we are constantly evaluating testing and training requirements to make sure that the program outcomes are achieved and that we're using these tools as they should be used and that we minimize the chance for violations around pesticide use in the state. Another key part of our natural resources program area is our land use program. Not surprisingly, the Department of Agriculture is a very strong advocate for keeping agricultural land in agricultural use and to try to minimize those exceptions for activities that are used on farmland. We know in a number of places in the state, Washington County being just one example, that the growing population can conflict with farming, and our whole goal is to keep agriculture viable in the state. So we are very engaged in land use issues and trying to be creative in how we address those. So it's not just purely a you can't do this or can't do that, but how can we work with neighbors or various sectors of the industry to reduce conflicts and allow private property rights. Certainly, Oregon agriculture is diverse, and it's diverse in terms of its geography. So what we do in the Willamette Valley is different than what's grown in the South Coast or in Central Oregon or Northeast Oregon. Again, that diversity and that ability to keep land in production is very, very important for us. So that's a quick overview of the Natural Resources Program area. There are questions?
Questions?
At this rate, we'll get through the whole presentation today. Okay. The third program area that I wanted to touch on is our plant program area. In this area, our goals are to prevent introduction of invasive pests, plants, and diseases and weeds. So pests, plant diseases, and weeds. Through early detection and rapid response, and that's a buzz term that you will hear a lot if you spend any time in the invasives world. It's early detection, rapid response. We also assist producers who grow plant products, so nursery and Christmas trees is an example, to get their products into market. And we protect threatened and endangered native plants from extinction. Invasives is an area that we spend a lot of time on, and again, there are a number of agencies that work on invasives in the state of Oregon. We, in particular, focus on pests and weeds and plant diseases, and in the pest area, as an example, in one biennium, we will install over 16,000 traps. We're looking for things like gypsy moth and Japanese beetle, and we put out traps all over the state. So we spend a lot of time putting traps out, monitoring traps, and then collecting them at the end of the year. One of the areas that we're looking for efficiencies is this notion of remote controlled traps. We have 300 of those in service right now where we put the trap out and we have a little camera in the trap, and we can monitor the trap that way as opposed to sending staff out on a regular basis to check the trap to see if we've caught anything. So we would hope to be able to deploy more of these devices in the future. We do a number of invasive pest surveys around the state, and then we also work on invasive weeds as well. And we've completed in the current biennium 337 noxious weed surveys. Senator Hansel spent a number of years on noxious weed issues and probably could speak to it even better than I could. In this program area, we adopt and enforce plant protection quarantines. These are things like exciting cherry fruit fly quarantines, blueberry maggot, apple maggot, European corn borer. I could go on and on and on. And I can tell you, the people that work in our plant area are fascinating people, and they love stuff like this. If you can sit down and talk to them about a pest or a disease, you can talk for hours. The state weed board maintains the noxious weed list of 100 worst weeds and helps to prioritize our program efforts on weed control, as well as our partners in county weed boards and soil and water conservation districts, nonprofit groups that work on weeds. And I think one of the things that we really like to stress about this program is there is a very much an integrated link between the work we do with pests, diseases, and weeds, and benefiting water quality. And it's really focusing on healthy riparian areas. And if we have riparian areas that are full of weeds, they're not fully functioning and doing the job that we want. So the work that we do in our plant program area also benefits the work that we do in our water quality area. The picture here is not a picture out of Star Wars. This is a real bug that we are able to analyze with some of our very high-resolution imaging microscopes. And there's a special name for this. Let me see if I can find it here. The scanning electron microscope, which allows us to do rapid insect identification. We're one of the few places in the United States that has this tool. We have a number of folks that will send us pests and ask us to identify those pests for them. In the past, it could take up to 6 to 9 months to figure out what this pest was. We would have to capture it, dry it, pin it, send it into a different lab, and then they could analyze it. But now with this new tool, we're able to identify pests in a matter of days as opposed to months. It is pretty amazing. And if you want a field trip, we invite you to come over to our agency and check out the great pests that we have that our folks just love. It's pretty amazing. We've been able to work in developing molecular analysis to identify origin of Japanese beetle at PDX, and this helps us to determine if it's a new beetle coming into the state or if it's an offspring to an existing infestation that we've had. And the answer to that question drives then the kind of treatment that we would use on that Japanese beetle. We are also a national leader in biocontrol of noxious weeds. We've released 77 species of biological controls against 31 noxious weeds over the course of the last probably 40 years. And we are currently in one of only about three entities that are trying to find a parasitic wasp for the brown marmorated stink bug. And this, as I've been told, is the nasty of all nasties of new invasive pests that have widespread ramification on the agriculture industry. So if there's an ability to find a biological agent for the marmorated stink bug, that would be a huge benefit for Oregon agriculture. And as I mentioned, the new exciting tool, the scanning electron microscopy, which allows for rapid insect identification. Just as I talked about in our market access and certification programs, we do a number of inspections and certifications as well in the nursery and Christmas tree industry. Again, if you're moving product out of state, you have to have an inspection from us and an accompanying phytosanitary certificate. And the way that we do that and being able to develop methods that are faster in response to industry needs helps the industry move its product to market. So we've done a number of scientific analysis in this area as well. We've got staff that have developed best management practices for Christmas tree export. We use our plant health lab for identifying Christmas tree invasives. And again, if you're shipping product to market, you need us to touch your product, and you need us to do it quickly and effectively, as well as if there's product that have pests in it, keeping that product from moving to the marketplace. One of the smallest programs in our agency, but one that has been a big challenge for us in terms of that sustainable funding, and so I wanted to highlight it for you here, is our threatened and endangered plant program. The threatened and endangered plant program gives us statutory responsibility to protect native threatened and endangered plants on public lands only. So it's not like the Endangered Species Act that it applies to all lands in Oregon. But we work to basically identify those very unique and endangered plant species, whereby work that we do can help protect them and keep them alive moving into the future. This is a program that in the past has had general fund, it's had lottery funds, and currently it's operating solely on grant funding. The staff in this program are very successful at going after grant projects, whether those are federally funded projects or projects funded by nonprofits to do specific work in specific areas. But there is a downside to limiting the funding in that program to that effort, in that we had an experience this year at Klamath Falls. The airport down there, which lost its commercial air service within the last year, has the potential to expand its runway with federal funding and potentially either get new commercial service or continued federal activity in its airport down there. In order to get the federal grant to even look at the feasibility of expanding the runway, they had to have a threatened and endangered plant survey. We didn't have the resources to do that. So we scrambled, and we were able to work with Business Oregon, and they gave us a grant to do that work because of the economic development tie. But it's a challenge for this program, and one that it's an area looking forward we'd like to try to find some better funding for that program.
Chair?
Yes.
You said a quick question.
Yes.
So you have a statutory requirement to provide these services. And in the last biennium, how you're using grants to fund, I guess, portions of that. I mean, can you tell me what that, the grant funding was in the last biennium and what it allowed you to do? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Co-Chair, we may need to go back and pull together that information for you, because I don't know off the top of my head. Let me see if staff, if anyone knows.
The federal funds about $200,000.
Okay. So about $200,000 to $300,000 in federal funds that we received over the current biennium. But we can go back and get a more complete list about that funding and the specific projects that it funded. And I think.
Yes.
Deputy Director Hansen also.
And what type of funding would it require to have as you were indicating, like a full-time staff?
Mr. Co-Chair, we don't even know if we'd need necessarily a full-time staff person funded with state resources. That would be a gift. It really would. And on average, the staff is about $200,000 a biennium. But even if we had just a core kind of seed money, it would allow us to do the kind of work that comes up in particular. But to be clear, that does not fulfill completely our statutory mandate. So it's been an ongoing challenge in this program.
What would you recommend, or what do you believe you would need to fulfill that statutory requirement?
So, Mr. Co-Chair, just to clarify, we are here to support the governor's recommended budget, and the governor's recommended budget does not include resources in terms of general fund. So I would say, that's the committee's purview. That being said, a half-time to a full-time position would go a long way to helping us do some of that core work.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question I had under the plant programs, early detection, rapid response are absolutely critical. When 40% of our 80% is going overseas, took a decade to get blueberries into Korea. A detection of blueberry maggot would shut that down immediately. Cherry fruit fly would shut down those markets. Where in the budget are we maintaining this department within this year's approved governor's mm-hmm. budget? I think the co-chair was getting at that as well. What would be needed to make sure that we maintain or expand in this area?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hansel, the governor's recommended budget for our plant program areas funds it at current service level. So we're not seeing cuts. We're not looking for enhancements in particular in that program area. And I think the important thing to remember is we get federal funds. A lot of the work that we do in the weed program, we get federal funding. If we have an outbreak of gypsy moth, Japanese beetle, or other kinds of pests, we go after federal funding to combat those, to do treatments. And that federal funding is not always stable. We're big advocates for USDA's budget on the invasive species funding, and that's an area where I think we will continue to be advocates in the future. But we've got to remember that federal funding is a key piece of what we do. And then Lisa's reminding me that we also have lottery funds in this program, in the plant pest program, as well as the weed program. And lottery revenue, as we know, is flat. We do need to take a small cut in our agency, in our lottery funds, so that will impact these programs a little bit.
Please proceed.
Okay. So we are ahead of schedule, which is great news. We're going to move into our fourth program area, and this is our food safety and animal health program area. Program goals here include inspection of all food processors and the majority of retailers in the state to prevent foodborne illness in Oregon. We protect Oregon animals and people from animal-borne diseases and prevent livestock theft. And we are working diligently to prepare Oregon producers for the implementation of the new Federal Food Safety Modernization Act. And that implementation is slated to begin later this year. This will basically result in a whole new area of growers in the state receiving inspections, and we expect a lot of those will be rather excited when we start doing that work, and we'll speak to that a little bit more in a minute. The food safety program area is our number one priority program in our agency, and the reason why is if we have a problem in food safety, that could potentially lead to serious illness and death. And so the human health component of the work we do in food safety work is always top of mind. We do inspect and license all food processors and retail establishments to ensure sanitary conditions and prevent foodborne illness. These inspections are risk-based. Inspections, we don't have a set time frame that we get to every grocery store in the state, and we have prioritized our programs to get to those places that are higher risk. That means some of the establishments may not see us but every year and a half or so. Oftentimes those are food store chains, as an example, that have their own quality assurance staff on staff. We know through our work with them that they do a good job, and frankly, they don't need to see us as often as maybe some other places do. But I think it's really important to point out that our inspection schedule is on a risk-based schedule. And the things that we're looking for, as my staff always remind me, because I'm not an expert in food safety, is some of the things are very simple. Keep hot foods hot, keep cold foods cold. Keep your meat juices separate from your vegetables. Don't let your little misters in your vegetable collect mold. I mean, it's some of those basic things that we're making sure happen that can prevent foodborne illnesses. We coordinate very closely with the Oregon Health Authority, and in the work that we do, if you'll remember, I mentioned we inspect most of the retail establishments, but we and health work closely together so we don't overlap. So health inspects all restaurants in the state. And if you are a grocery store where over 50% of your sales come from the deli, then health would see that grocery store. If you're a grocery store with less than 50% of your sales coming from food direct or deli kinds of sales, then it falls under our purview. So that's how we work with health to coordinate those inspections. And we have both adopted the same food code, so we're operating under the same standards. Obviously, the Food and Drug Administration is a key partner for us. And if there is a foodborne illness and we have to get involved in a recall, we have done that a number of times. We work in partnership with Health and the FDA to get that product off of the shelves and out of the food chain so that it cannot cause additional illnesses. We work very hard to provide technical assistance to startup food companies. We've seen kind of an upswing in those startup food companies. These might be, you know, Mrs. Jones down the street who has the best brownie recipe in the world, and she's going to start a domestic kitchen and make brownies for sale, not the marijuana and lace brownies, although that could be coming. And so, you know, it's easier for that person to contact us up front and say, I'm looking at remodeling and putting in a domestic kitchen. What do I need to put in place so that I'm in compliance? A lot easier to provide that technical assistance up front than to come in after the fact, see that she has done it incorrectly, and then it requires changes to her setup. So we really work hard for startup food companies to get them in compliance before they make those investments.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. You brought up domestic kitchens, and I've been licensed through your Department of Agriculture before as a food manufacturer, and there is a bill this session that would exempt domestic kitchens from licensure. Does the agency have a position on that? I just think that you can't put a dollar amount on that, like just because you're going to make less than $20,000 of gross sales, that somehow your kitchen's going to be safe based on actual revenue versus, you know, you can make one jar of jam and give somebody botulism. So does the agency have a position on that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, you bring up a topic that gets a lot of debate, clearly, and as we try to encourage the growth in, you know, startup companies and know that some of those will grow and become larger companies, we don't want to do things that impede their ability, but you're correct. Just because you're a small kitchen does not mean you're exempt from E. coli or botulism in your product. So I think we've not officially taken a position on that bill, but what we would counsel is look at the risk of the product that you're looking to exempt. So perhaps it's not just outright a certain dollar sale below which is exempt, but it might fall more along the lines of the kinds of products that you're producing that could be exempt. We had the same debate for a few years ago. Representative Clem was involved in the middle of that, and it landed after a lot of work in a work group. It landed on trying to differentiate products, so low risk products would not require our inspections, whereas higher risk products would. I would probably, just off the top of my head, want to steer people to that discussion around the exemption of domestic kitchens.
Do you have anything to add?
Senator Dembo.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative Parrish, we actually heard that bill in the Senate Environment Committee a week ago, I think, where it was actually well received. But that the point that Director Cobb is making about it depending on the kind of food product, I think, was relevant there, because this bill is just for baked goods, and I think the focus is really on bread making, and you know where the risk of foodborne illness is pretty low, and that was something that was stressed by all the people who spoke. I do have a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm intrigued by the demarcation between the Health Authority and Department of Ag for prepared foods. Is that a federal split, or is that something we do? And is it kind of arbitrary? I mean, I'm just wondering if that leads to some potential problems. You know, by 50% goes here, 50% goes there. I hear that you. I heard you say that you coordinate very closely with them. So I'm sure there's a lot of overlap. But I'm just wondering if that creates problems.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Dembro, perhaps I wasn't real clear. If a grocery store's sales, if more than 50% of the sales come out of the deli, then the whole store falls under the Health Authority. We're not in inspecting the half that's the grocery store, and they're inspecting the half that's the deli. So we coordinate that with them on those places where we think we're close, and basically say, you get it, we get it. My guess is this. So in answer to your first question, it's not a federal requirement, but this has evolved because many years ago, grocery stores didn't have delis. And so we did grocery stores and food processors, and health did restaurants. But with the growth of the diversity in grocery stores, that's changed, you know, how we think about that. And so we work very, very closely with the health authority in terms of making sure that, A, the establishment is covered, but B, we're not duplicating efforts. And I would say the relationship is a good one.
Great. So the delis become sort of quasi-restaurants, you know, when they hit that point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Demarest, that's correct.
Thank you.
Yes.
Another follow-up, actually. Who is actually involved in sort of the small-scale kitchens that are certified to produce, like, gluten-free or peanut-free products?
Mr. Co-Chair, I just wanted to double-check. That's us.
Okay.
So we also have a responsibility on labels to ensure that if it's gluten-free, that is indeed gluten-free and all of those other kinds of issues. So now is probably as good a time as any to bring up how we will be involved with Measure 91, because as you can well imagine, we'll have a pretty extensive role. And we're in the process of working with OLCC now on trying to figure that out. You will see we've got kind of a placeholder package in our budget request because we haven't got it figured out yet. But as an example on the food safety side, this is kind of, in theory, what we're talking about. OLCC will be responsible for issuing a license to a facility if they're using marijuana in edibles. So if we come to a domestic kitchen and they're making brownies and they're making marijuana brownies, our first question to them will be, can we see your OLCC license? If they've got their OLCC license to use marijuana, then we will conduct the inspection for the sanitation components that we normally do with any kind of food processor. If they don't have an OLCC license, we will not enter the facility, and we will contact OLCC and say, before we will conduct an inspection, you know, this firm needs to be licensed by OLCC. So that's kind of how we've talked about it on the food safety side. Clearly, we have a role in terms of licensing growers and still working out who is going to be the entity that licenses growers. We currently license all nurseries in the state, but not every grower is necessarily a nursery. And so where we've kind of landed, again, initially, is that OLCC will license the growers. If the grower happens to be a nursery and we come into the nursery and see that they're growing marijuana, we will ask them again for their OLCC permit. If they have it, then we will go about conducting our regular nursery inspection. If they don't have it, then we would refer them to OLCC and contact OLCC. There are also pesticide issues. There's water quality issues, farm use. You know, is marijuana going to be an agricultural product? If so, then it would fall under right to farm and EFU, all the protections in EFU zone land. So a whole litany of issues that where we touch and are trying to figure out what our role is going to be.
Follow up. We recently had a Democratic caucus, actually, in the Senate. And while I can't say what was said there, it was refreshing how little the Senate Democratic caucus knew about marijuana.
Largely.
There may have been exceptions. And being one of those that knows very little. Who's going to certify that if you're producing edibles, what the content is of those edibles, and who's going to be doing the testing on that?
Mm-hmm.
And are there problems with that?
Mr. Co-Chair, that is another key issue. And we have, you'll see when we get to our next program area, we have a regulatory lab in the state. This is the lab that will be certifying industrial hemp to make sure the THC content is below the statutory threshold for industrial hemp. So we have the capability to test for certain percentages of THC in marijuana. My my initial, again, not being an expert in this area either, I'm not sure in terms of the volume of lab tests we'll be looking at within the state, not necessarily that it would come to ODA, but just statewide in general. And if indeed the legislature choose to require that those tests be done by a state lab, depending on that volume, it could mean that we would need enhancements to equipment and staff in order to do that. So we have the capability to do that, but I don't think the decision has yet been made on whether that has to be a state lab or not, whether a private lab can do that. And then the whole, you know, if it says on the label it's whatever percent, who confirms that that is indeed accurate? If there's going to be some spot checking, I think the deputy director has a better answer than I do, or she can add to that. So go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. In recent conversations, the easiest way I've come to kind of bifurcate this, if you think about sanitation, that's ODA, keeping the food safe from cross-contamination. If you think about dosage, that is OLCC. So how much marijuana is in the edible would fall on the OLCC side.
Any additional? Okay.
Okay.
Please proceed. Oh, yeah. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Most of my questions were already answered. Thank you, Senator Devlin. But in addition, one other thing, obviously that's going to have, Measure 91 is going to have a fairly sizable implementation on your budget. Are you accounting for that? Is that something we're going to see as we go through? Is that, I just want to make sure that we're thoughtful about that, and that, you know, there's a lot of this that's going to affect your department, and how, you know, is that something we're going to hear as we go?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hack, yes, as I indicated, we have a placeholder package, which is, I think, one FTE, with the revenue source being the OLCC license fees. So we know that the intent behind legalization of marijuana is that the revenue from marijuana would pay for the state regulation of it. So we expect whatever we determine the department needs to do and the cost for that to come from OLCC. OLCC is aware of that. I think there's a little bit of nervousness about the startup costs may be higher than the revenue available to cover that. So a lot more to come on that, and we don't clearly yet know what the workload is in our agency. So that very well could be an issue that kind of gets set aside, and as we get closer to the end of session and the Measure 91 Joint Committee has better defined how it will be implemented at the state level, then we can better define the impact on our agency and come to you with a cost estimate.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Going back to the safety and dosage question, who's responsible for packaging and labeling?
So, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Gomberg, I think that's another one of those gray areas, because we are responsible for labeling. So if OLCC sets the dosage, but who's ensuring that the product is actually meeting that requirement, I think is something that needs to be worked out still.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Co-Chair. And I just want to make sure I'm clear. I'm not simply talking about labeling the dosage, but also safety labeling and warnings. Would that be on you folks in that gray determination?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg, my guess is that's going to be OLCC. As an example, they currently do the warning labels on liquor. Cigarette warning labels, I think, is health. So we have typically not been involved on the safety side in terms of the warning labels on issues in the past, so my guess is that will be OLCC.
All right, thank you. I'll ask them the same question.
You should.
Please proceed.
Okay. The last bullet on this slide, we do all of the surveillance and testing programs for dairy products, and that is a federal requirement to meet the Interstate Milk Shippers Compact, that all dairy products be tested, so we do that in our agency, as well as shellfish. That also is a requirement under interstate shipping for shellfish. So we test all shellfish And we also test waters in bays for things like domoic acid. And if that domoic acid level exceeds tolerances, we're the ones responsible for shutting down bays. So in this realm, we have been very involved with some members who are pushing a shellfish initiative and been engaged in that endeavor and doing what we can to help support that effort. And it's certainly a high priority for some of your colleagues this legislative session. Switching to animal diseases and livestock theft, we track the health and movement of all livestock and poultry to prevent disease outbreaks in Oregon. And we've had in Oregon some pretty high-profile disease outbreaks in the past. Again, this is very our approach to this is very similar to what we do in our plant program. We want to keep animal diseases out of the state of Oregon. If we do find them in the state, we want to eradicate them quickly. And some animal diseases do have human health impacts. And so that's the reason why this is also a very, very highly ranked program in our agency. My first year on the job in December of 2003 was the cow that stole Christmas, the outbreak of BSE in the dairy cow in Washington that had friends and family in Oregon. And we spent a lot of time on that issue, and clearly there was a huge human health component to that issue. There is also a huge economic impact when we have animal diseases. Our most recent case, high-profile case here in Oregon, that is the outbreak of high-path avian influenza, HPAI. We found it now in a couple of backyard flocks. Washington has found it, and California has found it in commercial flocks. When we found it in the first backyard flock in Oregon, we had 30 countries that put economic bans on poultry products, either from Oregon and in some cases from the United States as a whole. So what happens in Oregon in terms of animal diseases is not confined just to Oregon by any means. So animal diseases, the bottom line is they're bad, we don't want them, and if we find them, we want to eradicate them quickly. The state vet is housed within our agency, and our state veterinarian works with our federal counterparts in identifying emergency diseases, emerging diseases, risks, and implementing strategies, again, to keep those diseases out of the state of Oregon. It was our state vet, along with our district vet and our veterinary community, that really stepped up the efforts in dealing with the outbreak of HPAI. And we also have an animal health lab in our agency, which conducts all the testing to support the work of the state veterinarian and our district veterinarians. On the animal health side, you will have a package in front of you. It's actually a fee increase for our vet products, a registration fee, which funds part of the program. This is another area where we've had funding challenges over the past decade or so. We've lost general fund in the program. And even with the fee increase that we're proposing, it's not enough to maintain our current service level within our animal health programs. I think that our concern about that has been raised with the outbreak of HPAI. And this is an area where we're hopeful that we can get some additional federal resources into the state. On the livestock theft side, we register 11,000 brands in the state of Oregon. It's another fun thing you can do if you come over to the agency. You can look at all the various brands that we have. And anytime there's a point of sale on livestock, we have to inspect that point of sale to make sure that it's legal and that someone's not trying to sell stolen cattle. You can imagine with the increasing prices of beef over the last couple of years, we've seen a pretty big increase in stolen cattle losses. So through our brands program, that's our primary way of trying to prevent cattle theft. Again, this is a place where we have to be efficient, on time, and delivering those inspection services, because when a rancher's getting ready to move cattle, he needs that inspection and be able to move that cattle quickly. Food Safety Modernization Act. Even though the act is not in place yet, we have been spending a lot of time in our agency and preparing for this. This is probably the biggest overhaul at the federal level around food safety that we've seen in the last 50 years, if not more. And the whole effort behind FSMA was to become much more preventative in foodborne outbreaks as opposed to what a lot of people thought states and federal governments were just responsive and responding once the outbreak happened. So there are a number of components to FSMA. There are 7 different federal rules that are out for draft comment. Those need to be finalized by this fall, and then implementation will begin even later this fall. Under the produce rule, any grower that raises produce for the fresh market, again, there is a threshold level. If your sales are below a certain amount, you aren't subject to this new requirement. But if you grow produce for the fresh market, you will be inspected on farm for the first time ever. Even though we've tried to do a lot of education and outreach around the fact that this act is coming, we know a lot of people are not aware of it. And what we've also told the federal government is we're not interested in doing those inspections if there's not money that comes with it. So that has yet to be worked out at the federal level, whether there will be federal resources that come to the states to do these inspections. The president has included money in FDA's budget for fiscal year 16 to go to the states. It's not nearly enough, and we're working closely with FDA for the preparation of fiscal year 17 budget. But this will be an issue that we're going to be spending a lot more time on coming into the future. There are also other components of the rule. Rules coming at us. So we've been engaged in the draft rule process, in outreach and education, technical assistance. A lot more work to be done here. And again, the whole focus from our agency and from my colleagues around the United States is the federal government needs to fund this effort.
Colleagues, this might be a good time to break today before you go into the next section. We're actually ahead of time, I think, in your presentation. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay. With that, I guess you'll be back here tomorrow morning at 8:30.
Thank you. See you then.
Thank you.